This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Par Tolleson. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. And, well, I have to leave early today.
Why is that?
Well, I promised the Easter Bunny that I'd help him hide the eggs for this coming Sunday.
Bob, I don't think he needs any help.
Well, that isn't what he said yesterday.
You saw the Easter Bunny yesterday?
I had my picture taken with him.
And where was this?
Down at the mall. I sat on his lap and told him what color eggs I wanted him to bring me.
Bob, rabbits don't lay eggs.
Well, maybe not regular rabbits. This was the Easter Bunny.
Okay, and they're not rabbit eggs. They're chicken eggs.
Now, you're just being silly. How would a rabbit be able to get chicken eggs?
They were on sale this weekend.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Para, that doesn't help.
Oh, yes, it does. That explains everything.
That explains what?
The feathers.
What feathers?
The feathers that were around the house where I saw the Easter Bunny.
Now, what house was that?
Where they took my picture. You know, there was something strange about that house.
And what was it?
Well, it looked a lot like the house that Santa was in when I had my picture taken with him.
One thing you can say about Bob, he's becoming.
Really? That isn't what you said about me yesterday.
Well, you're becoming more and more like that all the time.
Is that good?
Never mind. Never mind. We started at the beginning of the year with bits of information that we had learned during our broadcast vacation. We'd like to fill that in a bit.
I know just where to start. There was once a Roman goddess of crossroads and graveyards. Her coming was foretold by barking dogs at night. She was also the goddess of sorcery and witchcraft.
What has that got to do with things that we've learned?
Ah, very interesting. Also related to three roads coming together.
And people who met at the crossroads often exchanged information about things that were happening at the places from where they had come.
Things that nobody else knew.
All thanks to the three roads coming together and the name of the goddess.
And what was the name of that goddess?
Trivia.
Trivia? You mean Regis Philbin worshipped a Roman goddess?
No, he hosted a game show dedicated to trivia.
And then he couldn't be there. Hecate filled in.
Who is Hecate?
The Greek version of trivia. Do you know that there was a Roman god named Robigus?
Never heard of him. What was he god of?
Mildew.
What has that got to do with trivia?
Well, in case the people stayed too long at the crossroads and it started to rain and they got rusty.
Moving on from there, how about some famous firsts? The first time men and women used separate bathrooms was in 1739 at a Paris ball.
The first ice cream cones were served at the St. Louis World Fair in 1904.
And did you know the story behind that first sale? It was a hot day, and the ice cream man ran out of cups. He couldn't find any more, and so he started looking for an alternative. Next to him was a fellow selling waffles. On a hot day, waffles weren't selling so well. He got an idea. He joined forces with the waffle man, and they started selling the ice cream inside a wrapped-around waffle. The ice cream cone was born.
And now you know. The first sport to have a world championship was billiards in 1873.
The first person to suggest daylight savings time, Benjamin Franklin.
Sugar was first added to chewing gum in 1869 by a dentist.
Well, let's make this one a question. Who was the first couple to be shown in bed together on U.S. primetime television?
It would have to have been a couple that were actually married. How about Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz?
Well, I think before that it was maybe Ozzie and Harriet. They had a family sitcom with real sons, David and Ricky Nelson.
Good guesses, but it was Fred and Wilma Flintstone.
That was animated. Does that count?
That counts for me. And speaking of laughter, how about the first time canned laughter was used on television? September 9th, 1950. It was on the Hank McCoon Show.
The first word spoken on the phonograph by inventor Thomas Edison? Mary had a little lamb.
The first person to set foot on all the continents except Antarctica? Captain Cook.
In 1776, the first country to recognize the new government of the United States, Croatia.
How about a first from Beethoven's Fifth, the first symphony to include trombones?
The first mosque to be built in the United States, 1893 in Ross, North Dakota.
Did you know that over 100 years earlier, freedom of religion was already becoming an issue? In 1776, the state of Pennsylvania was debating its state constitution. One group favored freedom for all religious expression, an opposing group wanted the freedom restricted to Protestant values only.
Even in North Carolina, in 1788, while debating the new federal constitution, there were some who opposed the freedom of religion statement because they didn't know who might be allowed in the White House in future years, possibly Muslims or, God forbid, Catholics.
Many of the founding fathers spoke in support of such absolute freedom. In 1776, John Adams published Thoughts on Government, in which he praised the Islamic prophet Muhammad as a sober inquirer after truth. Other such inquirers were Confucius, Zoroaster, and Socrates.
In 1785, George Washington stated a willingness to hire Mahometans, as well as people of any nation or religion, to work on his private estate. All that concerned him was if they were good workmen.
In 1790, South Carolina granted special legal status to a community of Moroccans. That was 12 years after the Moroccan head of state had formally recognized the United States.
In 1791, Benjamin Franklin, in his autobiography, stated that he did not disapprove of a meeting place in Philadelphia that was designed to accommodate preachers of all religions.
When he wrote of the movement for religious freedom in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson defended the principle, explicitly mentioning Muslims.
Any other firsts?
How about some beginnings? Leonardo da Vinci invented an alarm clock that woke you by rubbing your feet.
Numbering houses in London only began in 1764.
Mel Gibson broke a school record. The most whippings in a week. 27.
That's almost four a day.
I wonder how he sat at his desk.
Very carefully.
Not to be outdone, Sylvester Stallone was kicked out of 14 schools in 11 years.
Carnegie Hall in New York opened in 1891 with Tchaikovsky as guest conductor.
Bloody, changeful, laughable, sanctimonious. Words first used by William Shakespeare.
What a great segue into another important date in history that happened this week. On April 23rd, 1616, William Shakespeare died.
Don't we usually remember famous people on the day they were born?
Usually, but in this case, nobody knows for sure on what date Shakespeare was actually born.
We do know that he was baptized on April 26, 1564, so we assume he was born in the same year, but we don't know the actual date.
What we do know is that at the age of 18, he married 26-year-old Anne Hathaway in 1582. They had three children. Susanna, born in 1583, and twins Hamnet and Judith 2 years later. Hamnet died at age 11.
During his lifetime, he wrote 36 plays, over 150 sonnets, and poems.
I have a poem.
A poem by Shakespeare?
Well, not by him, but about him. Gather my children, and you shall hear of who wrote the plays of William Shakespeare.
I know what Bob is hinting at. There have been some debates over whether or not Shakespeare actually was the author of all the works credited to him.
Why do people doubt that he wrote his own plays?
Well, some claim that he wasn't smart enough, that he didn't know that much history, that he didn't know how English royalty would have acted, or just plain that he wasn't a good writer.
Well, if Shakespeare didn't write them, who did?
There are claims made that they were written by Sir Francis Bacon, or Christopher Marlowe, or Ben Jonson, and most recently, a fellow named Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford.
If that were true, why didn't they just use their own names?
It has been suggested that this kind of writing, sometimes described as bawdy, would have been beneath their dignity. So they used someone else's name, and that someone else was William Shakespeare.
Knowing people, everybody likes to take credit for what they've done. If somebody else had actually written the plays, I don't think they would have died without leaving a clue. They would have wanted somebody to know.
There's something to be said for that. We know that Boz was Charles Dickens. Mark Twain was Samuel Clemens. O. Henry was William Sidney Porter. Dr. Seuss was Theodore Geisel.
And George Eliot was Mary Ann Evans. Ayn Rand was Elisa Rosenbaum. And did you know the famous Bronte sisters, Anne, Charlotte, and Emily, once wrote under the names of Acton, Curran, and Ellis Bell? We even know the real names of Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Now, there were several writers who wrote those advice columns, but at one time, they were written by twin sisters. Their maiden names were Esther Pauline Friedman and Pauline Esther Friedman.
Which one was which?
I don't know. I told you they were twins.
Anyway, the point is that everyone wants to be recognized for what they do. I believe Shakespeare wrote his own plays.
Good point. Now, one other thing to remember, Shakespeare was a playwright, not an historian. Many people today confuse what Shakespeare wrote with what really happened. Shakespeare took sources and made stories out of them. For instance, Richard III was not a hunchback, and Macbeth was an admired and able monarch.
And Hamlet is based on a story by a 13th century Danish historian who made no attempt to separate fact from fiction. It's not even clear whether or not the Prince of Denmark even existed, but it's a great play. Have you seen that new version with David Tennant and Patrick Stewart?
Ta-da! I can tell the name responsible for putting the bard's words on paper.
And who was that?
Have you heard of a man from the 19th century named Waterman?
No.
He was the inspiration of Laszlo Biro.
I've never heard of a writer named Laszlo Biro.
Well, he's responsible for thousands and thousands of pages, plays and poetry and novels. Laszlo was the inventor of the ballpoint pen. Maybe you know him by his pen name, Bic. Very smooth writer.
And I suppose Waterman is a pen name, too.
No, Waterman is the name of the pen.
Then how could Waterman have been Shakespeare?
I didn't say he was Shakespeare. I said that the pen was responsible for putting the great bard's words on paper.
But Waterman didn't invent the fountain pen for another 300 years.
Well, Waterman was related to the old Quill family of Stratford-upon-Avon.
Bob.
Hey, don't forget, it was one of the Quills that wrote the will that left Shakespeare's wife their second-best bed.
Let me answer that. That fact has gotten lots of print with the implications that it carries. Let me offer another suggestion. The bed so mentioned is the second best bed. What was the first?
I don't know. What was it?
The guest room bed was the first best. Their bed was the second best. It was also their matrimonial bed.
Gee, that puts everything in a totally different light.
Yes, it does. And 1,000 times, good night.
You know, there are a lot of our common phrases, like that last one, that come from Shakespeare. No, aren't there?
Probably more than most people realize. Here are a few of them. A pair of star-crossed lovers.
A pound of flesh.
Sweets to the sweet.
A dish fit for the gods.
Brave new world.
Out, damn spot.
Something wicked this way comes.
Hey, that shows Ray Bradbury read Shakespeare.
Yes, he did. 'Tis passing strange.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
The better part of valor is discretion.
The primrose path.
Knock, knock, who's there?
The fattest knight at the round table.
What?
Oh, I thought you were starting a knock-knock joke.
No. Knock, knock, who's there is a quotation from Shakespeare.
An improbable fiction. Okay. Who was the fattest knight at the round table?
Circumference. I think it was caused by too much pie.
That way madness lies. Aren't you glad you asked?
For goodness sake, chaos comes again.
Good riddance.
And you thought that you'd never heard any Shakespeare? They are household words. They come full circle or in one fell swoop. They speak of the crack of doom or the milk of human kindness.
A spotless reputation is a foregone conclusion, whether wearing a lean and hungry look or having been eaten out of a house and home, whether the quality of mercy is not strained, or it's off with his head. Shakespeare is everywhere.
Did you know that some have even claimed a tribute to Shakespeare in the English Bible?
How did that happen?
Well, William Shakespeare, referred to most commonly as just Shakespeare, and, do you happen to know what his close friends called him?
No. What did his close friends call him?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't know him that well. Well, anyway, he was born in 1564. The King James Version of the Bible was authorized in 1611. So, for at least a few months during that year, Shakespeare would have been 46 years old. In Psalm 46 of this edition of the Bible, the 46th word is shake, and the 46th word back from the end is spear.
Which proves what?
That King James didn't know what his friends called him either.
Following that brilliant insight, it is true that Shakespeare had a tremendous influence on the English language. For instance, did you know that an educated person supposedly has a working vocabulary of about 15,000 words? The King James Bible uses 8,000 words. Shakespeare used about 30,000.
Speaking of the Bible, did you know that there are a lot of quotations from the Bible that are mistaken for Shakespeare?
That sounds like it could be a game.
Surprise! There is just such a quiz.
I'm up for it. Give us the quotations and we'll guess whether they come from the Bible or Shakespeare.
You can even tell us how our answers compare.
Okay, here we go. A wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother.
I know that one. It's from the book of Proverbs.
78% of players got that one correct. Next, if thou be wise, thou shalt be wise for thyself. But if thou scornest, thou alone shalt bear it.
Also, book of Proverbs.
Right again, but only 38% of the people got that one correct. Number 3. Surely I am more brutish than any man, and have not the understanding of a man. I neither learned wisdom, nor have the knowledge of the holy. Who hath ascended up into heaven, or descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fists? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his name, and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell?
I bet this one fooled a lot of people, but this one is also from the book of Proverbs.
Right you are on both counts. Only 43% of the people guessed that one correctly. How about, cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once.
From Shakespeare, spoken by Julius Caesar.
And correctly guessed 90% of the time. Next, all that glisters is not gold.
Often misquoted as all that glitters. It is from Shakespeare, spoken by Portia in The Merchant of Venice.
Guessed correctly only 69% of the time. Be wise in thine own eyes.
The book of Proverbs in the Bible.
Correct, along with 76% of other people. Number 7, love looks not with the eyes, but the mind.
This one's from Shakespeare, from Midsummer Night's Dream.
78% answered that correctly. Now, ill deeds are doubled with an evil word.
Shakespeare again.
From the Comedy of Errors, but only 60% guessed correctly. How about, riches profit not in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivereth from death.
From Proverbs.
90% got that one correct. And lastly, give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that be of heavy heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more.
Also from the book of Proverbs, but let's go back and read this verse from chapter 31 in context.
Good point, since only 49% of the people got that one correct.
That quiz wasn't so difficult.
Especially when you knew where to look.
I don't understand. They're just quotations. You guess whether they come from the Bible or from Shakespeare.
You don't have to just guess.
Right. You can answer based on known judgments.
And how do you do that?
Go to the 48th Psalm, count 48 words down, and you get the word known.
And then count 48 words back, and you get to the word judgments.
See, known judgments. You don't have to guess.
And what does that prove?
That 2 years later, King James still didn't know what Shakespeare's friends called him.
Why do I feel like I'm dealing with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern?
Yay! But there is madness in our method.
Methinks that is method in our madness.
Oh, that too. Anyway, we have written a play.
Yes, but a play that is so bad.
How bad is it?
Well, 'tis so bad that when the king sees it, all who are in it shall be condemned to death.
That is method. Where is the madness?
Well, we will convince Lord Hamlet to perform in the play.
Ah, that is indeed madness. But where is the method?
Once Hamlet is dead, we'll be free to marry Ophelia.
You mean I will be free to marry Ophelia?
No, I, Rosencrantz, shall marry Ophelia.
But you are not Rosencrantz. I am Rosencrantz.
No,
I. Oh, are you sure? Ah, there is method to the plan for Rosencrantz to marry sweet Ophelia.
Yet madness that we cannot agree on which is Rosencrantz.
Hey, let me help you. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Really?
Well, we'll just go ask, what's his name about it?
W.S. Gilbert.
No.
Tom Stoppard.
No, the guy with the second best bed.
Dead.
Never mind.
The works of William Shakespeare contain many of the great quotations about love that we repeat in the English language. If music be the food of love, play on.
The course of true love never did run smooth.
Love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind, and therefore is winged Cupid painted blind.
She's beautiful, and therefore to be wooed. She is woman, and therefore to be won.
I love you more than words can wield the matter, dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty.
Whoever loved that loved not at first sight.
The sight of lovers feedeth those in love.
Hear my soul speak. Of the very instant that I saw you, did my heart fly at your service.
Love sought is good, but given unsought is better.
I would not wish any companion in the world but you.
His unkindness may defeat my life, but never taint my love.
A heart to love, and in that heart, courage to make love known. For where thou art, there is the world itself, and where thou art not, desolation.
Come, what sorrow can, it cannot countervail the exchange of joy that one short minute gives me in her sight.
You have witchcraft in your lips.
Kiss me, Kate. We shall be married on Sunday.
That last was from The Taming of the Shrew, but the line has the familiarity of the Broadway production, Kiss Me, Kate, by Cole Porter.
By the way, Kiss Me, Kate opened on Broadway December 30th, 1948.
Beside pledges of love, Shakespeare could also write some great insults.
Thou art like a toad, ugly and venomous.
Thou art a fleshmonger, a fool, and a coward.
Hey, wait a minute.
A most notable coward, an infinite and endless liar, an hourly promise-breaker, the owner of no good quality.
Thy tongue outvenoms of all worms of the Nile.
Thou subtle, perjured, false, disloyal man.
You are a candle, the better burnt out.
What did I do?
Methinkest thou art a general offense, and every man should beat thee.
Thou poisonous bunch-backed toad.
Thy brain is as dry as the remainder biscuit after a voyage.
Thy face is not worth sunburning.
Oh, yeah?
You scullion, you rapallion, you fustilarian, I'll tickle your catastrophe.
There's no more faith in thee than a stewed prune.
That trunk of humors, that bolt-hunch of beastliness, that swollen parcel of dropsies, that huge bombard of sack, that stuffed cloak-bag of guts, that roasted manning-tree ox with pudding in his belly, that reverend vice, that gray iniquity, that father ruffian, that vanity in years.
Thou art unfit for any place but hell.
Well, your mother wears army boots.
What are you talking about?
All those things you were saying about me.
We weren't talking about you,
no,
Bob.
No, those were just some insults written by Shakespeare.
I knew that.
Nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Just remember what Shakespeare once said.
Help me.
All the world's a stage.
Bob, I think yours is getting ready to leave the depot.
Oh, I'd better go check.
No. If you go now, you'll miss the games.
What games?
The games that are mentioned in Shakespeare's writings.
Shakespeare invented games?
No, he didn't invent them, but he did use them as illustrations. For instance, archery. In Love's Labor's Lost, Mariah uses the expression, wide of the bow hand, which means something a good deal left of the mark. And many references are made to the clout, or center pin, on the archery target. So in Henry IV, Swallow says of Old Double, he would have hit the clout at 12 score. And of Romeo, he is shot through the air with a love song, the very pin of his heart cleft with the blind boy's butt shaft. The arrow hit its mark.
In Love's Labor's Lost, the phrase occurs, all hid, an old infant play. This could refer either to hide-and-go-seek or possibly blind man's bluff. Another game mentioned in the same play is backgammon, which used to be called tables. Here's the phrase. This is the ape of form, Monsieur the Nice, that, when he plays at tables, shides the dice.
And leapfrog. In Henry V, when the king says, if he could win a lady at leapfrog, or by vaulting into the saddle with my armor on my back, I should quickly leap into a wife. I wonder if that is something Game Boy would be interested in.
There was billiards, but slightly different. The table was square, with only three holes, all on the same side of the table. At the two corners, and then halfway between them, at about the middle of the table was placed an iron arch and a cone. At various times, the ball had to be driven through the arch and around the cone without knocking them down. At one point, Shakespeare has Cleopatra say, "Let's to billiards." This is a good example of Shakespeare the playwright, not Shakespeare the historian. The game had not been invented at the time of Antony and Cleopatra.
Cards. Numerous allusions are made to card playing, such as, "And heartily shall I carry out my side," which meant to win the game for you and your partner. And Cleopatra once says, "Nature wants stuff to vie strange forms with fancy." To vie meant to raise the stakes. And also popular were dice. The confident and over-lusty French do the low-rated English play at dice. But all was not fair at love and war. Often the dice were rigged or loaded, and were termed high men or low men. In some cases, the term was high fulhams or low fulhams.
And chess was well known from The Tempest, "that thou mayest be a queen and check the world." Or in The Taming of the Shrew, Katerina says, "I pray you, sir, if your will be to make a stale of me amongst these mates."
There were also some games with which we are not familiar. Bat fowling. It was the practice of hunting small birds at night. It is also used as a slang term for the dishonest practice of asking a shopkeeper for light outside, claiming you had lost something. While he is obliging, you rob his shop.
There was cherry pit, a game of tossing cherry pits in the little holes. Very ungraciously, in Twelfth Night, speaking of the disfigurement of the lady's face, it is said, "You may play at cherry pit in the dent of their cheeks." Not very nice.
Fast and loose. A cheating game whereby gypsies and other vagrants would cheat the common folk of their money. From Antony and Cleopatra, "He, like a gypsy, oftentimes would go, all kinds of gibberith he hath learned to know, and with a stick, a short string, and a noose, would show the people tricks at fast and loose."
Flipping the toad. Two boards were placed across another at right angles. A frog was placed at one end, and a bat was used to strike the other end, sending the frog high in the air. In Henry IV, "If I do, fillip me with a three-man beetle."
And flat dragon. A small combustible object was set on fire and then floated in a glass of alcohol. Someone would attempt to drink the liquor without the fire doing damage. In Love's Labour's Lost, "Thou art easier to swallow than a flat dragon." And in Henry IV, Falstaff says, "And drinks of candles ends for flat dragons."
One last sport mentioned was football. From The Comedy of Errors, "Am I so round with you as you with me, that like football you do spurn me thus? If I last in this service, you must case me in leather." Football is known to us, but did you know it was once banned? In 1349 it was prohibited because it impeded the progress of archery. James I said, "From this court I debarred all rough and violent exercise as the football, meatier for laming than making able the users thereof. It was from the violence of football that first came the line, 'So wise, so young, they say do never live long.' What they really mean is, 'To be or not to be?' That is the question."
When you read any Shakespeare, the first thing that strikes you is the difference in language.
That sure is true. It's written in English, but there are some words I've never heard before.
And some words that are familiar, but don't seem to mean what I thought they meant.
A good point. So I thought it might be interesting to present a brief Shakespearean glossary. A few words that you might never have heard before.
And some ones with a slightly different meaning.
And some of those may surprise you.
How is that?
When you hear their definitions, those meanings may actually be more correct than the way we use them today. For instance, unkind.
For us, that means not to be nice or pleasant.
For Shakespeare, it meant unnatural, i.e., not of its kind.
You know, that's interesting. So that suggests that people were meant to be thoughtful and nice. If they're not, then they are unkind in more ways than one.
Unready, it meant undressed.
If you're not dressed, you're really unready.
World, as in, she's a woman of the world. We sometimes put a negative connotation on that phrase, but it actually meant only that the woman was married.
That makes sense. Before a girl was married, she was secluded from things. Once she was married, she became involved in all aspects of life. She needed to be to help her family.
A villain was only a low-born man, and vulgar meant only the common people.
Now, those words aren't just a recognition of social difference. There's a sense of superiority involved.
In that same view, tag.
That was one of the games they played.
Maybe, but it meant the rabble, like the ragtag bunch.
Sounds to me like just a bunch of kids playing tag.
How about aspersion?
That's when you drop a little hint that something is less than it seems.
For Shakespeare, it was a sprinkling or a blessing.
A blessing?
Sure. What do you do with aspersions?
Well, you cast them.
You cast aspersions.
Oh.
When the priest walked through church, bestowing blessings on the people, he sprinkled them with holy water.
While we're receiving our aspersions, odds bodkins.
Isn't that odds bodkins?
No, odds has an apostrophe, and it's bodkins spelled with two I's. It's an oath, God's little body.
Sort of like bloody. I think we have to go back for some more aspersions.
Wassail.
A Christmas drink.
Could be, but it just meant a drinking bout or festivity.
Oh, no wonder fraternities have Christmas parties.
Mess. That was a group of four.
Now, you know, that's funny. Two is company, three's a crowd, and four is a mess. Especially you have to clean up after the wassailing.
A lifter is a thief, and a knave is just a serving boy.
And abreast is a voice.
A voice?
Sure. If you admit the truth, you make a clean breast of things.
Obsequious. It means acting like one does at a funeral.
Quality. Of the same rank or condition.
Now that's interesting. In Oliver, when the youngsters with Fagin said that they were all quality, they weren't saying they were better than anyone else. They were just saying that they were just as good as everybody else.
Pied. That's P-I-E-D. Wearing a motley coat, like a jester. Thus, the Pied Piper.
And motley meant multicolored, just what the fool or jester wore.
Did Motley Crue wear funny colored coats?
If they wore coats at all. A couple of strange usages. Setter, a person who watched travelers to give information to thieves.
An undertaker, someone who took up someone else's quarrel.
And some Shakespearean words you don't normally hear. Gore-bellied, it meant corpulent.
Fascinorious, wicked.
Fartuous, it was a word used ridiculously to indicate someone who is ridiculously virtuous.
Kisky-whisky, a wife used in disdain.
And at the top of the list, anthropophaginian.
You're right, I've never heard that one before. What does it mean?
It means a cannibal.
That reminds me, did you know that Julius Caesar was an anthropophaginian?
Where did you hear that?
Shakespeare said so in his play. He said, et tu, Brute? That means, after you, Brutus. And Brutus did. He took a big slice out of Julius Caesar.
Calm down, Kurt.
I can only think of one thing to say. Off with his head.
After hearing all those words, I have to tell you a secret. Down at an old second-hand bookstore, I found an unpublished work by Shakespeare.
You found a new play by Shakespeare?
Well, no, not a whole play. Just a short soliloquy. You know what a soliloquy is, don't you?
Certainly. It's a dramatic monologue that gives the illusion of being a series of unspoken reflections.
Does that mean a guy going off and just talking to himself? Because that's all this is. You know, come to think of it. I had an uncle that gave a lot of soliloquies. He was always off in the corner talking to himself, especially after he'd been wassailing. There was this one time...
Never mind about your uncle right now. About this piece by Shakespeare, how can you be sure that Shakespeare had written it?
Well, it sure sounds just like him, the kinds of words he uses and all. Well, just listen. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the coming of fishing season. All that glisters is not gold. Rather, the glister is reflection of golden sunlight upon a sylvan-girded lake. What piece of work is a shining trout as it leaps clear of its watery home to dine in the ethereal mist from which God hath wrought? Ah, indeed, 'tis such stuff as dreams are made of. 'Tis beauty, indeed, in the eye of the beholder. I dream. Yea, the world is my oyster. An itching palm to sore afflict me as I sense the nearing of the trout. The trout, yea, the trout. The trout by any other name would taste as sweet. Now in my mind's eye, yea, in soul truth, I see it. With bated breath my nimble fingers doth work to fix my line. What lure seemeth best? Methinks that those who speak of the spinner and the spoon doth protest too much. Indeed, they be but a tempest in a teapot. The eye of newt, possibly even the toe of frog, with barbs sharper than a serpent's tooth. Yea, measure for measure, they have as much power to tempt as any feathered pomp and circumstance of brief authority. Now, once more into the breach I cast full circle, knowing not from which side, east or west, shall come the strike. Gently I flick my wrist, for I know that the play of the line is the thing. I trust my nylon fiber, for surely the quality of the line is not strained. Calmly I wait, calmly anticipate. Oh, how poor are they that have not patience! Suddenly it comes, a hit, a palpable hit. To be or not to be, my first catch of the season. Perhaps to dream that it be a pound of flesh. Out, out, damned trout, out of the water and into my net. Now to gaze upon thy greatness. What? Is this a pilchard that I see before me? Alas, poor Yorick, it's a sorry sight. Be this a dish fit for the gods? Nay, a thousand times nay. There exists neither rhyme nor reason why I should take thee home. Get thee to a hatchery.
Kurt, what's the matter?
I'm listening.
To what?
The sound of William Shakespeare saying, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, as he turns over and over and over in his grave.
Can you ask him what his friends call him?
Thou foul defacer of God's handiwork.
Kurt, wait a minute. Don't you think that's a bit strong, even for Bob?
That's not about Bob. That's a segue from some of the best literature in the English language to some of the worst. In 1830, Edward Bulwer Lytton wrote a novel entitled Paul Clifford. It was a successful novel, but it opened with a sentence that has become the epitome of over-the-top writing.
Let me guess. This has got to be the dark and stormy night.
It was a dark and stormy night. The rain fell in torrents, except at occasional intervals when it was checked by a violent gust of wind which swept up the streets, for it is in London that our scene lies, rattling along the housetops and fiercely agitating the scanty flame of the lamps and struggled against the darkness.
In 1982, San Jose State University in California began a contest which invited entrants to supply the opening sentence of a proposed novel that would follow in the footsteps of The Dark and Stormy Night.
You mean bad writing?
Not necessarily just bad, but extreme, gothic, superfluous, overly ornate, flowery, ostentatious, out of proportion, and way over the top. In a word,
bad.
If you must. So in contrast to Shakespeare, here are some of the past winners of the Edward Bulwer Lytton contest.
In 1983, The Camel died suddenly on the second day, and Selina fretted sulkily and buffing her already impeccable nails, not for the first time since the journey began, pondered snidely if this would dissolve into a vignette of minor inconveniences like all the other holidays spent with Basil.
In 1985, the countdown had stalled at T-minus 69 seconds when Desiree, the first female ape to go into space, winked at me slyly and pouted her thick, rubbery lips unmistakably, the first of many such advances, turning which would prove to be the longest and most memorable space voyage of my career.
In 1986, the bone-chilling scream split the warm summer night in two, the first half being before the scream, when it was fairly balmy and calm and pleasant for those who hadn't heard the scream at all, but not calm or balmy or even nice for those who did hear the scream, discounting the little period of time during the actual scream itself when your ears might have been hearing it, but your brain wasn't reacting yet to let you know.
In 1988, Like an expensive sports car, fine-tuned and well-built, Portia was sleek, shapely, and gorgeous, her red jumpsuit molding her body, which was as warm as the seat covers in July. Her hair as dark as new tires, her eyes flashing like bright hubcaps, her lips as dewy as the beads of fresh rain on the hood. She was a woman driven, fueled by a single accelerant, and she needed a man who wouldn't shift from his views, a man to steer her along the right road, a man like Alf Romeo.
In 1990, Dolores breezed along the surface of her life like a flat stone, forever skipping across the smooth water, rippling reality sporadically, but oblivious to it consistently, until she finally lost momentum, sank, due to an overdose of fluoride as a child, which caused her to lie forever on the bottom of her life, as useless as an appendix and as lonely as a 500-pound barbell in a steroid-free fitness center.
In 1992, as the newest Lady Turnpot descended into the kitchen, wrapped only in her celery dressing gown, her creamy bosom rising and falling like a temperamental souffle, her tart mouth pursed in distaste, the sous chef whispered to the scullery boy, "I don't know what to make of her."
In 1993, she really wasn't my type, a hard-looking but untalented reporter from the local cat box liner. But the first, second, and the third-rate representative of the Ford estate cracked open a new fifth of scotch. My sixth sense in seventh heaven was as close as the eighth note from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So as nervous as a 10th grader drowning an 11th hour cramming for a physics exam, I swept her into my longing arms and humming, "The 12th of Never." I got lucky on Friday the 13th.
In 1998, the corpse exuded the irresistible aroma of a piquant ancho chili glaze, enticingly enhanced with a hint of fresh cilantro as it lay before him, coyly garnished by a garland of variegated radicchio and caramelized onions, and impishly drizzled with the glistening rivulets of vintage balsamic vinegar and roasted garlic oil. Yes, as he surveyed the body of the slain food critic slumped on the floor of the cozy but nearly empty bistro, a quick inventory of his senses told Corpulent Inspector Moreau that this was, in all likelihood, an inside job.
In 1999, through the gathering gloom of the late October afternoon, along the greasy, cracked paving stones slick from the sputum of the sky, Stanley Ruttlethorpe rearily trudged up the hill from the cemetery where his wife, sister, brother, and three children were buried, and forced open the door of his decaying house, blissfully unaware of the catastrophe that was soon to devastate his life.
In 2000, the heather-encrusted headlands veiled in fog as thick as smoke in a crowded pub, hunched precariously over the moors, their rocky elbows slipping off the Land's End, their bulbous, craggy noses thrust into the thick foam of the North Sea, like bearded old men falling asleep in their pints.
In 2001, a small assortment of astonishingly loud brass instruments raced each other lustily to the respective ends of their distant musical choices as the gates flew open to release a torrent of tawny fur comprised of angry, yapping bullets that nipped at Desdemona's ankles, causing her to reflect once again, as blood filled her sneakers and she fought her way through the panicked crowd, that the annual running of the Pomeranians in Liechtenstein was a stupid idea.
In 2003, they had but one remaining night together, so they embraced each other as tightly as that two-flavor entwined string cheese that is orange and yellowish-white, the orange probably being a bland cheddar, and the white, mozzarella, although it could possibly be provolone or just plain American, as it really doesn't taste distinctively dissimilar from the orange. Yet they would have you believe it does by coloring it differently.
In 2004, she resolved to end the love affair with Ramon tonight, summarily, like Martha Stewart ripping the sand vein off the shrimp's tail, though the term love affair now struck her as a ridiculous euphemism, not unlike sand vein, which is, after all, an intestine, not a vein, and that tarry substance inside certainly isn't sand, and that brought her back to Ramon.
In 2005, As he stared at her ample bosom, he daydreamed of the dual Stromberg carburetors in his finished Triumph Spitfire, highly functional, yet pleasingly formed, perched prominently on the top of the intake manifold, aching for experienced hands, the small, knurled caps of the oil dampers begging to be inspected and adjusted as described in Chapter 7 of the shop manual.
To those illustrations of neo-unclassical, anti-Jacobean, post-traumatic stress syndrome writings, I say, parting is sweet sorrow. So let's turn to some Shakespearean quickies. Unlike most artists of his time, Shakespeare did not live in poverty. His will, besides his infamous second-best bed, contained several large landholdings.
Did you know Shakespeare never attended a university?
When William was born, there were two families named Shakespeare in that village.
What happened to the other one?
Oh, they didn't become famous.
Did you know that 13 suicides occur during Shakespeare's plays, twice in Julius Caesar and 5 times in Antony and Cleopatra?
Do you think it had anything to do with Roman cooking?
I'll go right on pasta, that one. In 1584, Shakespeare was caught poaching and had to leave the area for a while. He ended up in London working in a theater, and a career began. Question, if he hadn't been caught, would he still have written all the plays?
He was baptized on April the 23rd. That's April 23rd on the old Julian calendar. If we were to go by the Gregorian calendar that was adopted in England in 1751, we would be celebrating on May 3rd.
On June 29th, 1613, the original Globe Theater burned down. The fire was started by a cannon shot during a performance of Henry VIII.
Did you know that theaters were big business? They attracted crowds of up to 3,000 people. The theater was also used for bear baiting, gambling, and other, immoral purposes.
3,000 at a time. The more the merrier. And remember, a merry heart doeth good, like a medicine.
Shakespeare didn't say that.
No, but the Book of Proverbs did.
Well, the merry hearts raised a few eyebrows. Objections were voiced by the respectable citizens and the church. Many Londoners were strict Protestants, Puritans even. They were not amused.
Oh, villain, villain, smiling, damned villain!
From the few signatures we have of Shakespeare, we find that he never signed his name William Shakespeare. The closest was Shakespeare, and it was either with an E-A-R or an E-A-R-E. But never the way we spell it today.
Shakespeare's acting troupe was called the Lord Chamberlain's Men, after James I gave them a patent to perform for him and made the members of the troupe grooms of the chamber. They were renamed the King's Men.
The London Football Club from Tottenham was formed in 1882. They were originally named after a character in Henry IV, Harry Hotspur.
Before Shakespeare died, he issued a curse on anyone who dared to disturb his remains from their final resting place in Holy Trinity Church, where he was buried in April of 1616. Good friends, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust and close it here. Blessed be the man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones.
Shakespeare is known as a great Elizabethan playwright, but a great deal of his work was produced while James I was king. Maybe he should be known as a Jacobean playwright.
Did you know what was the only named dog in a Shakespearean play? There are many dogs mentioned, but only one is called by name, Crab, in The Two Gentlemen of Verona.
One of the passengers on the Mayflower was Stephen Hopkins. He had made a previous voyage to America in 1609 aboard the Sea Venture. During that voyage, the ship was wrecked in Bermuda, and Hopkins was stranded there for a time. That tragedy became the inspiration for The Tempest.
Although often credited to Shakespeare, he never used the word gadzooks.
I have one last comment about Shakespeare. Did you know that he had 3 brothers, Gilbert, Richard, and Edmund? And all 3 hated him.
Why did Shakespeare's brothers hate him?
Well, because he was an only child.
Done to death by slanderous tongue.
And one other thing. Did you know that a man who won the Bulwer Lytton contest in the year 2000 was Gray Dahl of Los Gatos, California? He was also the inventor of the pet rock. Thus, I breathed life into a stone.
Speaking of inventing things, how about some more inventions of sayings? Back in the old English sailing days, sitting down for a meal could be an interesting time. If the seas were rough, your plate could go skidding down the table along with coffee cup, utensils, and anything else. To prevent the problem of your meal slipping away from you, four pieces of wood were nailed to the table in the form of a box. The plates, silverware, and all were placed inside the box where they stayed put. You were having a square meal.
Sometimes when ships were about to leave port, a smitten sailor might attempt to smuggle a lady friend aboard. It does get cold at sea. And where would be the best place to hide a girl? In your hammock. So, as part of the final inspection before a ship left port, the duty officer required anyone still in their hammock to stick a leg out from under the blanket. If it was hairy, fine. If it was nice and smooth, not so fine. So in order for the ship to get going, you might have to show a leg or shake a leg.
Speaking of cold, before we leave the sailing ships, there is one other expression that, in its origin, was neither crude or rude, simply descriptive. To be instantly ready for battle, cannonballs were stacked at each gun emplacement. To keep them from rolling around the deck, remember the square meal? Well, the same thing could be done for the cannonballs. A metal plate with raised edges was welded onto the deck and was called a brass monkey. The cannonballs were stacked on the plate, kept in place by the lip. But when it got very, very cold, either the weld might break or contraction would cause the cannonballs to fall off the pile and go rolling around the deck. When that happened, you knew it was cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey.
In Tudor England, the ladies were all very proper and wore their hair pinned up. You see pictures of the period where the women wore these pointed hats called wimples. Beneath the hat, the hair was pinned and secured into position. When the day was over and they retired to their boudoirs to indulge in other activities, it was time to take off the wimples and let their hair down. Now it's a more symbolic expression and can take place anywhere.
Under the ancient rules of forestry, peasants were allowed to take from the royal forest only those things that could be reached by extending their shepherd's staffs, also called a crook, into the forest. If they wanted it, it had to be done by hook or by crook. Another version of the origin is that when Cromwell vowed to take Ireland, he would attack either through the villages of Hook or Crook.
Do you remember a recent story about Giles Corey in Salem Village during the witch trials? They hadn't invented waterboarding yet, but the practice used on poor old Giles wasn't unusual. In case a person had forgotten whether or not he had done what he was accused of, they would pile rocks on his chest until he remembered. You can see that he was pressed for an answer.
During the Great War, the Vickers machine gun came equipped with an ammunition belt that was 9 yards long. Now you know when you get the whole package, you get the whole 9 yards.
Once upon a time, the only light in the house came from burning candles.
Did the candle-making company offer a discount on candles if you let them put a device on the candle that it would extinguish it during peak hours?
No. During peak hours, if you needed more light, you took the candle out of its holder and lit the other end as well. It used up the candle twice as fast because you were burning the candle at both ends.
Jolly old is old but small. A while back, when they started running out of places to bury people, they would simply dig up the old grave and use it again. But when they did, they began to find many, many cases in which there were scratch marks on the inside of the casket. They began to realize they had been burying people alive. To prevent that, they tied a string on the hopefully deceased's hand and ran it up through the ground to a bell. If the string was pulled, the bell would ring. A guard, whose job it was to patrol the graveyard, would hear the bell and take action. If you had that job, you were working the graveyard shift.
Did you know, as an attempt to not let things get that far, the practice sitting up with the dead took place where the person could be observed before the burial? It was called the wake.
If you travel to the walled city of York in northern England, you'd be able to visit the narrow, cobblestoned medieval shopping district. Such districts were quite common in olden times and also quite disorganized. goods everywhere and people pushing barrows around trying to get things from one location to another. What a mess. In fact, the place was in shambles, and that is what the district was called, the shambles.
How about fortnight? The British expression for 2 weeks. Hadrian's Wall, which was begun in 122 CE, was a fortification built across Britain. The wall had forts situated at places along the wall, and every 2 weeks the sentries were allowed to sleep inside the forts. So every 2 weeks they had their fort night.
Kurt, as we get close to the end of this program, have you seen the new translation of Shakespeare?
I'm afraid to ask.
Really? It's like a combination of Shakespeare and Nostradamus. It's a version that relates to events taking place right now instead of 500 years ago.
Have you got an example?
Well, here's one that actually refers to us. Listen. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the beam of a subchannel receiver tuned to the broadcast of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Oh, yes, I do know about that version. The quality of mercy is not strained. It poureth out as programming for the print and visually impaired.
So friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. There is so much special programming offered by the Triangle Radio Reading Service that a single set doth not suffice.
O Romeo, Romeo, hast thou not told thy friends who are print and visually impaired how they can call the Triangle Radio Reading Service to arrange for a subchannel receiver?
I go, and it is done. The bell invites me. But the bell will not ring unless you call 832-5138.
In my mind's eye, I see the number. It must be 919-832-5138.
To be or not to be, that is the question of whether or not we ever will find out what Shakespeare's friends called him.
This is Kurt Benrud. A spotless reputation hath the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and a thousand times good night as we end this edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolson, the be-all and the end-all of programming for the print and visually impaired, and cakes and ale to all those who have helped support the efforts of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
A feast of languages every week, Thursday at 9 p.m., Saturday at noon, and Sunday evening at 8.
A king of infinite space is the internet which carries podcasts of our program following the initial broadcast.
And this is Bob Martin, a blinking idiot. Wait, that's it? That's how I'm supposed to end this program? There's got to be something better. How about taking a look at my pet salamander? I call him Tiny. He's not so small, but I call him Tiny because he's minute.
Chaos is come again.
What's gone and what's past help.
Out, out, brief candle.
This is the end of our tribute to William Shakespeare.
We hope we have brought you some interesting information and entertainment to you.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be, but please, continue to listen in and support the work and programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
From Bob, from Para, and from me, now go we in content.
When shall we three meet again?
Until next week,
goodbye.